MacCast, Sunday, February 24th, 2019. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Glad to be sitting down here with you again for another great week of Apple and Mac news, information, and also some great feedback, tips and tricks, and all that other good stuff for you. Yeah, it's been a pretty good week. I hope you had a good weekend. I hope you're having a good week, depending upon when you're getting down or sitting down to listen to this, rather. Maybe you're standing up or running. I know a lot of you exercise while listening to the podcast, so way to go on closing those rings, if that's what you're working on. But we have some good things to get into this week, including taking a look at something going on with FaceTime again. Yeah, something's happening there. We'll talk about that a little bit. Universal apps coming, and what does that mean, and when will we see those? What are we expecting at this year's upcoming Worldwide Developer Conference, especially for those Mac Pro users out there? A little bit of information about Apple's car project, and then we're going to round things out with a bunch of quick stories. I'm going to call these things Apple Quick Bites, because every once in a while we'll just have little tiny stories that really don't fit their own category, but I want to cover nonetheless the just little interesting tidbits happening this week. And that'll kind of round out the news. Then we're going to get into some feedback. We're going to follow up on a couple things from a few episodes back. I'm going to talk to you about desktops and documents in iCloud. Yeah, I have some information there you might be interested in. Also going to follow up a little bit on iPad wall mounts. We got some great feedback from a listener on that. Get into some tips about gestures that you might not know about. And then we'll round it out with a little bit of discussion on what's happening with next-gen phone technology. Yeah, there's some new phones that came out this week that may influence where Apple goes in the future, and I want to talk with you about that and get your opinions on maybe where phone technology is going. And that will round out this episode of the MacCast. But before we get into it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, and that is Smile. I want to talk to you about PDF Pen, one of my favorite Smile applications. Really is the ultimate tool for editing and dealing with PDFs. And I know it's not super fun to talk about, but you know, this time of year, it's the year I rely on PDF Pen probably the most. I use it all year long, but tax time, it's looming. I'm getting ready to do that. I think I have my appointment at the beginning of April, and I have to deal with all kinds of PDFs and documents and forms and stuff like that. And I do everything paperless, so having that stuff OCR'd and searchable is critical for me. And of course, PDF Pen does a great job of doing that. It also lets me mark up those documents, add any annotations, highlight things that I might want to send over to my tax professional to talk about or take a look at. It helps me fill out those fake forms. So basically, things, documents that I get sent that are PDFs that are supposed to be forms, they look like forms, they have little lines on them, but they actually don't have form fields. So often people will resort to printing those out and hand filling them in. Don't have to do that with PDF Pen Pro. You can actually auto detect all of those form areas, and it will make those fill-in forms like they should have been from the very beginning. And then you can, of course, easily add a signature. And then finally, when I need to send that stuff off to my tax professional, it's got sensitive data. Very often, my Social Security number. I want to be able to secure that with a password so I can send it digitally. PDF Pen lets me do that also. And of course, I then call my tax professional with the password. Don't include that in the email. But it is a great tool for managing all your PDF needs. Of course, PDF Pen Pro also adds additional features. Like I said, creating those fillable PDF forms, converting websites into PDFs, and a whole lot more. You can learn all about PDF Pen and PDF Pen Pro by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. That's smilesoftware.com/podcast. And a huge, huge thanks to Smile for their continued support of the MacCast. Just when you thought it might be over for FaceTime and specifically group FaceTime, Apple has a little bit more egg on their FaceTime. Is that too bad? That's horrible. Yeah, we won't say that. Apple is losing face on FaceTime. Let's say that a little bit more, because after fixing the embarrassing group FaceTime bug with the release of iOS 12.1.4, it turns out the troubles aren't quite over. You might remember that bug allowed you to potentially add users to a group FaceTime call, and their microphone would pick up automatically, even though they didn't pick up the call. So there was a procedure you could go through and basically start listening in and eavesdropping before someone picked up the group FaceTime call. Worse, in some instances, you could also get them to trigger the video without them realizing it. So it was a pretty bad bug. Apple jumped on it, shut it down pretty quickly. To their credit, they shut it down at the server level, and they did push out a patch with iOS 12.1.4. But now that issue is fixed, it looks like some of the former functionality is still broken, at least according to Mac rumors. They say if you start a one-on-one FaceTime call and then try to add an additional person, it is often grayed out and will not work. It's not clear if this is intentional or a bug, though it does seem like a bug because a couple people called up Apple support and the phone reps said, yep, we know it's an issue, it's a known issue, and we are working on it. So we're expecting a fix to come around. The workaround right now is if you want to do a group FaceTime call, you need to include all your participants up front, or at least start a three-way call, and then apparently you can add additional users, although some people are also reporting getting a grayed out add a person button there as well. So your mileage may vary on that one. But for right now, if you do want to do a group FaceTime, just get everybody on the call right up front, and that should avoid the issue. And hopefully Apple will fix this little bug relatively quickly. Another thing we're hearing about this week is the potential for universal apps for macOS, iPhone, and iPad. This is something Apple actually started talking about at the last Worldwide Developer Conference, but Mark Gurman, reporting over at Bloomberg this week, says that Apple has a goal of enabling developers to write an app once, basically have an app code base, and then easily deploy to macOS, that app rather, to macOS, iPhone, and iPad, and they are targeting 2021 as the rollout for all of that, although it is going to phase in a little bit. This is something that was being called Project Marzipan. And like I said, the first phase is kind of already out there, I guess, but really the first phase for developers is expected to launch later this year, something they're likely going to show off at this year's Worldwide Developer Conference. And the report says that the first version will let developers deploy iPad apps on the Mac using the same code base. And this would be using techniques similar to those that Apple used internally to bring applications like the Stock app, the Stocks app, the News app, and the Home app to the Mac in macOS Mojave. So those, if you've ever launched those applications, you can tell they're sort of progeny. Is that the right word? I think so. Progeny in iOS, right? They are basically the iOS apps brought over and made to work with a point-and-click interface and menus and all those things on the Mac, but they still use the underlying code from iOS. And that is what Apple's going to open up to developers. iPhone apps are going to soon follow, I guess maybe in the year after that. So the full rollout by 2021. Now, these are not going to simply be, you know, iOS apps, touch-based apps on the Mac. They're still going to require different business logic and some tweaked interface code to work properly, but that will be able to be all rolled in. So you kind of have the core code base and then slightly tweaked logic and then different interfaces that you could develop and roll up all into a single application package that developer could then deploy to all those platforms. And Apple is expected to show off these new tools at this year's Worldwide Developer Conference. That is expected to happen from June 3rd to June 7th in San Jose, California. So Mac Rumors did some digging and kind of pinpointed those as the dates. Apple hasn't announced the dates officially, but that's when it is currently rumored to be happening. And all of this reportedly plays into Apple's plans to start moving the Mac onto their own chips and will help make Mac, iPhone, and iPad apps work more seamlessly together. Now, Axios reported sources inside Intel saying that they also believe Apple is moving to make custom chips and that they could do it as early as 2020. Of course, Intel is Apple's major supplier of chips for the Mac, the only supplier of chips for the Mac right now, and they're expecting that business might start dwindling as early as 2020. And we've been talking about this a little bit. It seems like the next logical step for Apple to bring their processor technology, which has been so great on the iOS platform, over to the Mac. When and how they're going to do that is the big question. A lot of us believe, myself included, that they might start with something like the Mac Mini or maybe a consumer-level notebook. But I've also heard an interesting theory that maybe they could do it in their Pro machines, considering that's sort of a smaller market. So they could start with the lower volume systems and really high-powered ARM-based processors. Of course, there's a lot of factors that have to go into making that happen. Tweaks to the operating system and also probably working hand-in-hand with a lot of their major software developers, third-party software developers, companies like Adobe and Microsoft to make sure that their applications are going to work as well. But Apple has gone through a successful transition like this in the past, moving from IBM to Intel. So presumably they should be able to do it again. And they have been likely working on it for a while. I wouldn't find it at all surprising to hear that they actually have Macs running right now on ARM-based technology, you know, versions of macOS running in labs and things like that. So that is expected to happen. Don't worry, though, they are not going to be combining the operating systems into a single OS. That is still expected to remain separate because Apple still does internally view the desktop experience as a very different experience from the tablet and iPhone experiences. So iOS is still going to kind of maintain its own identity, macOS as well, but they are going to be moving closer and closer in terms of the feature parity and sort of crossover features and stuff like that. And we've been seeing that happen for the past few years. So just expect more of that as Apple transitions to the ability for both the operating system to kind of come together and also third-party applications from developers using technology like Marzipan. Another thing that is starting to be rumored as possibly being revealed at Worldwide Developer Conference is the new Mac Pro. Yeah, is that finally going to happen? Is it actually going to ship at Worldwide Developer Conference or near Worldwide Developer Conference? I wouldn't go that far quite yet, at least not according to the rumor mill. Of course, Apple promised the machine in a secret meeting with a few elite Mac journalists way back in 2017. And since then, they really have not said much except to say that, hey, the Mac Pro's not going to be here in 2018. And it certainly wasn't. I think they've kind of committed to having it out by the end of 2019, if I'm remembering right. But once again, Mark Gurman, reporting over at Bloomberg, says he claims that he has sources inside Apple that say the company has, quote, internally weighed previewing a new version of the high-end Mac Pro at Worldwide Developer Conference, although they have not made a final decision on that yet, so it may or may not happen. But they are reportedly considering it. And we've heard that Apple is really trying to get this one right, which is possibly why we've had such a huge delay from the time they talked about it with those Mac journalists. They are targeting VR and high-end cinema production as major applications, and we have heard that they have a pro workflow team that has been out and about, sort of entrenched in various parts of the pro industry, kind of analyzing workflows, taking a look at how pros are really using their systems, trying to get a lot of feedback to all go back into what Apple is calling a new modular design for the Mac Pro, right? The big thing for pros is the ability for expansion, the ability to customize, to really kind of build the machine that is going to work best for their workflows. The question is Apple going to be able to pull it off this time? Because as cool as the 2013 Mac Pro was, it fell a little bit short. And Apple has already admitted and recognized that they made some missteps there in making assumptions about what pro users want. So this time around, they're really trying to, I think, do a lot of polling, figure out what pros are really looking for. And supposedly that's what's taking all this time. I just have this fear that it is taking way too much time. There was also a kind of, I'm going to call it a sketchy rumor this week that came out from a YouTuber that he claims having sources telling him that Apple is going to have a stackable modular design that will basically use a custom data connector to connect various modules. A lot of people thinking they're going to look sort of like little Mac mini modules, but each one kind of having a separate functionality. So you would have a core kind of base station module that would have the CPU and a lot of the controller hardware, maybe a couple ports on it. Then you would have a GPU unit, almost like an eGPU, so there'd be different modules and versions of that, different storage modules, different I/O modules, and then you could mix and match and stack those together. I think this is a really great concept and could be something that Apple is considering. I do question the source of this rumor, though. You know, I wouldn't put it out of the question. Sounds interesting. There would be a lot of engineering challenges, but we know Apple never shies away from those. So that could happen. And I think it could serve the pro market very, very well, because again, you could kind of mix and match. But you could also do the same thing with just a big tower design with a lot of expansion. We talked about this on the iOS show this week with Michael Johnston. I was on there and this subject came up and we both agreed, you know, Apple could have just put out, you know, relaunched the cheese grater with upgraded specs, and that would have probably satisfied a lot of pros. Of course, that's not the Apple way of doing things. They are going to try and wow us with something really amazing. And with how long it's taken, I think they're just setting the bar higher and higher for themselves. So expectations are going to be through the roof. So the question then becomes, are they going to give us a preview at Worldwide Developer Conference? And that is what a lot of people are believing. Now, a preview means they're going to show us what they're up to, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be able to run out and buy one. And I think doing that has the potential to disappoint a lot of pros who have already been waiting a really, really long time, which may be why Apple hasn't made that final decision yet. Is that the right move? I have really mixed feelings about it, and I'd be curious to know how you feel about that, especially if you are a pro user. Do you want a peek behind the curtain only to maybe be disappointed if Apple, for some reason, can't end up shipping it by the end of the year? We've seen this with products like the AirPower, right? Apple pre-announced that. They haven't been able to ship it, and it's sort of been disappointing for a lot of us, and it does make the final launch of that thing, I think, anticlimactic. It's like, okay, it's finally here, big deal. We finally got it. And Apple has the potential to do that if they can't deliver on the promises of the Mac Pro this year. So do they show it off and potentially risk that? Or is it better to wait and not show us anything until it actually is ready to ship? And I kind of feel like I trend toward the latter at this point, just because Apple's had so many missteps with pre-announcing products. But I'd love to know what you think. Shoot me some feedback. Send me an email, maccast@gmail.com. Or even better yet, give me some audio comment. I haven't received a lot of audio comments lately, and I'd love to share some of your thoughts on a future episode. So send those along, maccast@gmail.com. Also expected to come along with the new Mac Pro is a new Apple Pro display. We talked a little bit about this. I think Ming-Chi Kuo had some speculation and some rumors on that. It's looking like Apple is planning on delivering a 31.6-inch 6K design with, quote, outstanding picture quality. And now we're hearing possibly using a new mini LED-like backlighting design. So that would be pretty cool. And I think a lot of people are, you know, looking forward to Apple getting back in the display business as well. So those two things coming along together, the Mac Pro, the new Apple Pro display, it could be a very exciting year here in 2019. And like I said, Apple made the promise of a 2019 release date. If they are considering a summer preview, then we might not see that product until the end of the year. And really, considering the fact that the current Mac Pro was released in 2013, yes, it did get a rev at one point. I still think the schedule's somewhat embarrassing. You know, it really is at this point. And I'm not holding my breath anymore, I guess, is what it really comes down to. One other little bit of Pro news that is a little bit more immediate, and it is good news if you like AMD GPUs. Apple updated their eGPU support document this week to include the AMD RX 560 in the form of support for the Sonnet Radeon RX 560 eGFX breakaway puck. This is an eGPU from Sonnet, and it has the AMD Radeon RX 560 in it. The 560 had originally been supported in early beta versions of macOS High Sierra, but it was actually removed before release, so a lot of people have been waiting for this to come back. It does unfortunately come with one slight caveat that you should be aware of. Apparently, playback of HDCP protected content from iTunes and certain streaming services is not supported on displays connected directly to an RX 560 based eGPU. The playback of the content can be viewed on the built-in display of a MacBook Pro, MacBook Air, or iMac, just not through the eGPU. And, you know, man, copy protection, content protection, really what I would call content restrictive technology, so annoying. And I didn't like seeing that in this announcement, but at least if you need that AMD RX 560 support, you do have an option available now for your Macs, your iMacs and your MacBook Pros and MacBook Airs. So some decent Mac Pro news this week. We've talked a lot in the past about Apple's rumored car project. It's gone back and forth from being a car project to an autonomous systems project and seems to be moving back into a car project again. Although, what if that car isn't a car at all, but is maybe a van? This is a little bit of a far-fetched story, but a German magazine is proposing that Apple's secret car project is actually a van project. They claim to have sources that have seen black and silver prototypes, and they say that the vehicles being tested are actually vans and not cars. They also claim in the report that engineers are working on the interiors of those vans. That's about all the news that is in that rumor. What does that actually mean? I have some of my own possible theories on the reasons why they might be reporting on this. I think the most obvious is that we had heard a while back that when Apple was kind of building out the autonomous systems, that one project they were thinking about doing was developing an actual van based on, I think, a Volkswagen van platform that would be used in-house on campus to shuttle employees between their various campuses in Palo Alto and Cupertino. So that could be something that they're trying to set up as a test platform, and maybe that is what they're seeing, and that is sort of the genesis of this rumor. The other thing is that Apple is or has been rumored to be working simply on autonomous systems. This is something that Tim Cook himself has actually commented on, and a van platform could be a great test bed for that, right? You've got a lot of room for that equipment, and maybe it's simply, you know, it's just something as simple as that, that they're actually testing their autonomous systems. They're using a van as a platform. They've also used SUVs, or we actually know they're using SUVs on the road, Lexus SUVs, I believe, for their current tests. So there could also just be some confusion about SUVs versus vans and those sorts of things. So as you can tell, I'm not trying to read too much into this rumor. If I put my sort of tinfoil hat on, though, and want to pump up one of my own theories, it could be that Apple is still planning on using the autonomous system to build out a car as a service platform, a CaaS platform, as I'm going to call it. And I've talked about this a little bit on the show. I think that Apple could ultimately be looking at the future of transportation and looking at the fact that, especially here in the United States, so many of us have multiple vehicles, often two-car families, and very often at least one of those vehicles goes unused quite a bit of the time. So the idea would be we buy fewer vehicles, we subscribe to a service, say from Apple, that provides a car on demand, an autonomous vehicle on demand, and a van platform could be very interesting for that. And this is where, from this report, I'm kind of reading into the fact of engineers working on the interiors of these vehicles. So imagine more of a rolling room, right? Because once you're not a driver, you're simply a passenger inside a vehicle that maybe doesn't need a dashboard or a steering wheel, right? Those sorts of things. You kind of have a room that you can more or less hang out in. And then what do you do while you're in there? Well, you have different rider experiences, right? You're going to want entertainment, maybe some Apple Music. How about an Apple Video service? What is that going to look like? What are those screens going to look like? Maybe you want to have some augmented reality displays pointing out the sights along the way. Or if you want to go to a store, it could pop up retail locations, maybe even advertising that's tailored to things that you might be looking for or interested in. So, you know, you're interested in a new Apple product, happen to be driving by an Apple store, maybe up on a augmented reality display on the windows, you get product information or information about a sale that is ongoing, and you can sort of detour from your destination for a minute and stop off and do that, whatever it might be. So building out those experiences around a car platform or a van platform starts to make quite a bit of sense if you start to think about it. So it could be something like that. That last one is really just my own speculation based on no facts whatsoever, but I think it's an interesting thing to think about. But let me know what you think. Shoot me some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. All right, finally in the news for this week, a couple of Apple quick bites for you, starting off with the Apple Watch. Ming-Chi Kuo thinks that the ceramic version might be coming back. Apple did get rid of its Edition watch, I think, last year with the launch of the Series 4. Ming-Chi Kuo said in a note to his clients that that could be coming back with the Series 5. He didn't give any details on pricing or how it would fit into the lineup, other than, hey, that material might make a resurgence. He also did say that Apple is planning to bring ECG support to more countries this year with the Apple Watch Series 5, but he didn't mention specifically which ones. Over the past several years, Apple has been working very, very hard to build out their own mapping data for Apple Maps. Those of us who have been around long enough remember that Apple started out with Maps data from Google. That didn't go all too well for Apple, so they decided, hey, we're going to do it ourselves, and they've been spending a lot of time and effort to try and improve their mapping data. And as part of that project, one of the things they've been doing is having their own vehicles drive around not only the US, but also other countries. Well, here in this in the States over the past few years, they've been using LiDAR-equipped vehicles, those SUVs that I talked about, over the past 3 years, and they've been driving around in about at least 45 states that we officially know about. I think we've seen them in more than 45 states in the U.S., but officially Apple has noted on their website that there's about 45 of them. Well, soon they will be adding a few other states. Alaska, South Carolina, and Tennessee are going to be added between March and July of this year. Apple has yet to confirm vehicles mapping the last two states, which would be Arkansas and Oklahoma, although we have heard reports of Apple vehicles map vehicles being in those states from various sources. The additions of Alaska, South Carolina, and Tennessee were revealed on Apple's updated map collection site. And there it also lists where Apple is going to be roaming around and collecting data at the street level using pedestrians. And that is something they have followed suit with Google on. So Apple started out with driving vehicles around. Now they actually have human beings walking around some of the areas where vehicles wouldn't necessarily be able to get to. So a lot of greenways and parks and those sorts of places. Also, we've seen them building out mapping data inside locations like malls and airports and those sorts of things. So Apple really doubling down on their mapping data and at least expanding to almost all of the states in the U.S. And one of those states in the U.S. looks like they're going to be having some Apple stores close up in, that is Texas. Apple is closing down two northeastern Texas Apple stores, Apple Stonebriar and Apple Willow Bend, which is bad news for those of you who might live in those areas, but don't feel too badly because they are opening a new store to pick up the slack just a little further to the south. And they're closing these stores not because they aren't performing well, but actually to avoid patent trolls. Yep, believe it or not, they are running away from the trolls in Northeast Texas. That is because the Eastern District of Texas is actually home to some of the most patent troll-friendly judges in the United States. A lot of patent dispute cases are brought to trial there, or have been brought to trial there because of the friendliness of that district. Well, in 2017, a ruling was made that limited patent infringement cases to districts where the defendant, quote, operates a regular and established place of business. Apple tried to argue at one point during one case that having retail stores in there didn't constitute them running businesses or having a regularly established place of business in that part of Texas. That did not hold up. So it's looking like they're deciding, well, we're going to get out of Dodge at this point. We're going to actually move down to the Galleria in Dallas, which isn't too far away from those other two locations, and we'll just close up shop here. That means we're not going to get pulled into these crazy lawsuits in these troll-friendly courts. So that's what's happening there. If you happen to live in that region, I'd love to know your opinion on this. Is it frustrating? Is it going to be a big inconvenience that you're not going to have access to those two stores? It looks like geographically the distances aren't too much farther, but again, Texas is a big state and I don't live there, so I'd love to know what you think about it. And then finally, some great news if you own a Google Home product and you're an Apple Music subscriber. Apple Music started showing up as a supported service in Google Assistant. And don't get too excited though, because right at the moment as I'm recording this, although it could change by the time you hear this, it seems like it is showing up in the app as a music source, and when you try and sign in, that part isn't really working. So they might still be rolling it out. You can't seem to authenticate, but it is listed in the application, giving the promise that very soon you'll be able to set up Apple Music as a music provider for your Google Home devices. Very similar to the way you can set it up on an Amazon Echo device at this point. So Apple opening up Apple Music a bit more to some of their competitors, and I think that is a great thing. I think that's a great way to expand the reach of Apple Music, and ultimately I think Apple ends up winning, and also consumers end up winning, because you can get Apple Music working with the home assistant device, home speaker of your choice. So between that and AirPlay 2, it's very nice to see Apple opening things up, and I thought that was a great bit of news to kind of round out the Apple news for this week here on the MacCast. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another show sponsor, and that is Hair Club. Hey, look, your confidence is important, and sometimes one change can make all the difference. Hair Club knows this, and that's why they're inviting you to become part of the Hair Club family to see how getting the most out of your hair can change your life. They understand the emotions you're feeling and know the questions you have. Hair Club is the leader in total hair solutions with a legacy of success for over 40 years. So whether you're looking to revitalize the growth of your own hair or to learn more about the latest proven methods for hair replacement or restoration, Hair Club's professionally trained stylists, hair health experts, and consultants will craft a personalized solution to ensure you feel your best and you get the most out of your hair. So far for me, hair loss has not been an issue, but this was something that my dad struggled with. It did bother him, and I remember him doing some crazy stuff, like standing on his head, because he had heard that if you could increase the blood flow to that area, that could help slow hair loss. So try to get blood to the scalp. He thought that was going to work. So he was doing crazy stuff like that. And with Hair Club, he could have been able to rely on real and proven solutions. If you want to find out what Hair Club can do for you, go to hairclub.com/MacCast. That's hairclub.com/MacCast today for a free hair analysis and a free take-home hair kit, all valued over $300. That's hairclub.com/MacCast for a free hair analysis and a free hair kit. And a big thank you to Hair Club for their support of the show. A couple episodes back on the MacCast, I had mentioned my reluctance to use iCloud's desktop and documents syncing. I think we were talking about alternatives actually to iCloud and maybe running your own private cloud and different ways that you could do cloud-based syncing but not use some of the services like iCloud or Dropbox or Box.net or any of those out there. Basically, roll your own private solution and accomplish that in various ways. But we also did talk a little bit about some of iCloud's options. I think it was really about syncing your Macs across multiple Macs and having access to all of your documents and different ways that you could do that. And I brought up the fact that one of my main concerns with using iCloud's desktop and document syncing was that it has a feature where if your Mac gets low on disk space, it will start to automatically remove older files from your local drive, files that are in your documents folder or on your desktop, because it actually has them stored in iCloud. And my concern was, is then you only have a single copy in iCloud, you don't have a local copy, and you have no way to locally back that up. So it's not going to get picked up by Time Machine. It's not going to get picked up by any clone backup. It's not going to get picked up by any offsite backup, because it no longer actually exists on your Mac. And Apple sort of decides, or Mac OS, I guess, really, the operating system decides what gets to stay and what leaves. I mean, really, technically, like I said, it's older documents, stuff you haven't opened in a while. That's the stuff it's going to put up into iCloud. And this is handy if you have a machine with limited storage. So maybe you have 128 gigabyte MacBook Air, something like that. It has limited space. This could be a good option for you. Again, I still have concerns about Apple being the only source of my files. And so I brought that up on the show, and almost immediately after that episode aired, I had many of you write in to say, hey, Adam, you know, you don't have to run it that way. You actually have an option to not have local files deleted when you start running low on space. And I went to take a look at it, and sure enough, if you go into System Preferences, into iCloud, and click on the options under iCloud Drive for the documents, desktop and documents in iCloud, there is a little checkbox down at the bottom that says Optimize Mac Storage. It is checked, I believe, by default, but if you uncheck that, that tells it that, hey, on this Mac here, you cannot delete the local files if I start to run out of space. You need to leave everything here on this Mac. Now, that does defeat the, you know, functionality or the option of sort of automatically freeing up space as your internal drive gets full, but it leaves everything on your local system so you can make sure that you're not relying 100% on iCloud for some of your backups or for the backup and storage of some of your files. And so because of this, I went ahead and decided, okay, I'm going to give this a try. I'll go ahead and enable it. Also, many of you wrote to say to me, hey, I've been using desktop and documents syncing with iCloud, and it works really well, and I really, really like it and enjoy it. So you talked me into it. I decided to give it a try, and I have to say, I am enjoying it so far. I am really liking desktop and document syncing, specifically because it gives me access to everything that is on my Mac on my iOS devices, specifically my iPad Pro, which I often use as a laptop replacement. So I'm often out and about only with my iPad Pro, and I don't have my MacBook Pro with me. So having access to everything on my desktop or in my documents folder from iCloud is a really great advantage. Now, if you do decide to take the plunge and enable desktop and document syncing, there are some things that you should be aware of and you should know about. When you turn it on, it does move the desktop and the documents folder into the iCloud section on your Mac. So they will appear under the iCloud section in the sidebar, and you're no longer going to see those folders inside your home folder. And that definitely is a little bit freaky at first. It made me panic a little bit at first because they basically disappeared from my home folder, and that's where I'm used to seeing them. And they are moved over into the iCloud documents folder. So you need to go into the iCloud or the iCloud Drive folder rather. So if you go into the iCloud Drive, you'll see them right there. Everything will get moved over. It's all fine, but it is a little bit of a different location. Gets a little bit, takes a little bit of getting used to, I guess is what I want to say. So just be aware of that. Also, be aware that if you have multiple Macs that you're enabling this feature on, by default, what it's going to do is it's going to create folders for each one of those Macs inside the desktops and inside the documents folder. It doesn't try to do any merging of those two Macs separate desktop or documents directories. And that's likely a good thing because maybe you have some duplicate files. You might have to kind of resolve any of those conflicts. So you ultimately can merge and combine them into a single location that is syncing across both your Macs. But by default, Apple doesn't try to figure that out for you. So you need to kind of do that little bit a little more manually. But once you've done that, then you can get it down to a single location, you know, just the desktops folder in iCloud and just the documents folder in iCloud. So be aware of that. And then on iOS, if you want to access everything, those desktop and documents folders are available inside the Files app or in any application that can access the iCloud location. So you can find all your documents and your desktop items inside there, and you can manage them inside there. And by default on iOS, it only downloads some of those files, right? So that you can preserve space. You'll get the little cloud icon. If you want to click on a file to open it up, it will download it on the fly. Of course, you can pre-download that stuff if you need to work offline, but you will need to kind of plan for that. So that is another thing to be aware of. And then finally, be very, very careful, because this one got me, about deleting items and where you're deleting items, especially if it's not inside the Files app on iOS. I tried to open up a file inside GarageBand, so accessing the iCloud location from inside GarageBand, and it was a GarageBand file, but I received a prompt that said, hey, this file was created on a Mac, I can't open it on iOS. And so I thought, well, shoot, if I can't open this on iOS, I don't want to see it on iOS. And so I deleted it inside GarageBand, not realizing that it was also going to actually delete it from iCloud and then also from my Mac. So I completely deleted it across all of my devices. And you do need to remember that. Once you're doing desktop and document syncing, it is a syncing operation, right? So any action you take on your iOS device is also going to be taken on your Mac, and it's going to be synced across all your devices. And of course, I knew this. I just wasn't thinking it all the way through. And luckily for me, as you know, I'm a backup fanatic, so I had Time Machine on my Mac. I just went back to my Mac, launched Time Machine, and I was able to recover that file relatively quickly once I realized my mistake. But it was kind of a little panic, you know, heart in your throat moment for me, thinking, oh my gosh, what have I done? I've just deleted this GarageBand file. So some stuff to think about. It isn't perfect, but it actually is pretty nice, and it seems to be syncing up fairly well for me and matching up with what many of you told me, which was, hey, I use this feature, it works great. So I'm a little less leery of it now, a little bit more in that pro camp, again, with the few caveats that I just mentioned. So if you want to try it out, again, make sure you have good backups, be aware of what you're doing, but I think it is probably a useful feature for a lot of us. Another thing I want to follow up on a little bit is our discussion about iPad wall mounts. We had a listener write in or email in and ask about, hey, I have an old iPad. I want to use it as a control surface for my home automation. I want an in-wall mount for it. Do you have any recommendations? And I had found one product, but I certainly am no expert. And I had asked you, if you know of anything, write in and let us know about it. Well, I received an email from Robert, who actually works in this industry. He does stuff with smart home technology solutions. He does installations, and he had some great advice and a recommendation. He says that the brand that's sort of industry standard for them is a brand called iPort. You can find it at iPortProducts.com. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. Now, the solutions are professional level solutions. They're not necessarily cheap, but I didn't think they were too badly priced for what they were. They have great high quality materials. They look like they're really well built, and Robert says they are. The solutions start at around $299 US, and they do go up from there depending upon the features and styles that you want. But one important factor Robert pointed out to consider when you're doing an installation, an in-wall, you know, permanent installation of an iPad, is you want to make sure that you think about wiring and power. Even if it's low voltage USB or power over Ethernet, and especially if you're dealing with high voltage direct charging outlets, you want to make sure that stuff is done correctly and to code. So if you're doing it DIY, make sure you check all of those things, you are aware of what you're doing, and you stay safe. Otherwise, you probably do want to use a professional to at least do the wiring. But what's really cool about the iPort products is that they have great designs that are set up for routing all the wires, for doing the installation, for providing you with powering options, and everything that they have fits into a standard junction box, in-wall junction box, or a J-box. And so it all mounts up nicely, and it looks like a nice clean installation. So that might be something you want to check out if you're considering wall mounting an iPad. iPortProducts.com. Although Robert did say in the world of home automation, the in-wall solutions or the permanently mounted solutions are kind of going away now that we have voice assistants and speaker products, things like the Apple HomePod or the Amazon Echo or the Google Home products. So more clients are opting to not have a actual display or a physical control and simply use voice control, which makes sense to me, but it still seems like the in-wall solutions or some sort of permanently mounted solution. You could even go just with a stand solution on a side table or something like that. That seems like a really nice way to possibly reuse or repurpose an older iPad, like an iPad Mini 1 or an iPad Mini 2. And Robert also mentioned that, you know, in-wall solutions, mounted solutions are also great reuses for your old iPod Touch or an old iPhone. So those things could be repurposed as a permanent controller for home automation or your Apple TV or something like that. So that's a cool option. And Robert even said he has a mounted solution inside his garage to serve as a control surface for his irrigation system. And that means like people like his landscapers can get in there and have access to that and easily set up and change the programming for his irrigation controls, which are all built into his home automation. And more people are wanting to do this. So I think this is a great topic for discussion here on the MacCast. One thing I'd love to hear about is various home automation solutions that you have put together, especially if it's DIY stuff, that have been successful for you, or maybe even talk to us about some of your failures and what you learned from that, things that you tried. I think I talked about here on the MacCast the fact that I was an early adopter of the HomeKit stuff from Insteon, and I haven't been really happy with it. But I've started switching over to some of the products from LifeX, and I am really, really enjoying those solutions. So little things like that, sort of learning from our mistakes, finding products that work really well, integrate with technologies like HomeKit. So what are you doing out there? What kinds of things are you doing with home automation, both in terms of what are you buying, how are you integrating it, and maybe even what sort of software and solutions, what kind of automation stuff are you setting up and really enjoying? Shoot me some feedback, especially send me some audio comments, maccast@gmail.com. Something we talked about a little while back was what I was calling hidden UI or hidden interfaces on the Mac. And I think we got into some gesture-based stuff, but I realized we haven't gone really deep into maybe gestures that aren't all that obvious on our iOS devices. And I've come across a few of these recently, and I thought this would be another good thing that we could share with each other. So again, be thinking about gestures and gestures maybe that you use that not everybody might know. And I'm going to give you some examples of these across a couple different applications, starting with the calendar. I learned recently that you can move events around on your calendar pretty quickly and easily, and you can also add new events just by using touch. So rather than just tapping the plus icon and entering some details, you can actually tap and hold in the day, week, or month views to add a new event, and it'll plop down a new little block and then pop up the information panel at that time or at that specific point in your calendar so that you can actually fill out the details for an event. And I thought that was pretty cool. You can also tap, hold, and drag around the items if you want to move something. So if you have a meeting that was set on one day and you want to move it to another day, you can actually just tap, hold it, and drag it around inside the calendar app and move that to another day and time. And then finally, another kind of cool little gesture you can do inside the calendar is in the week and day views. If you tap and hold on the little info block, you'll get little handles at the top and bottom, and then you can tap and drag those handles to move the start and end times of an event, sort of just like you would with a text selection, right? If you tap and hold a word, you get the little handles on either end of that word. You can drag them out or back to change your selection. This works the same, but kind of vertically in the week and day views. And so you can change the start and end times of your event. So there's a couple cool little gestures you can use inside calendar. Here's another couple for mail.app. In mail.app, did you know that you could tap and hold on the compose icon? to get a list of messages that you have in your drafts. So if you started a bunch of messages, left them in drafts, and you want to see all of those, tap and hold on the compose icon. You'll get this nice little drop-down window, and it will show you your draft messages. And you can tap on one of those and continue finishing that up. And also in that same drop-down at the top, there is a new message link as well. And then inside that dropdown, if you have maybe a draft message that you started that you don't need anymore, you can actually swipe across that to get the little trash icon or the delete icon, and you can delete it right from that little panel. Found a couple new gestures that I started using and playing around with in Safari. If you swipe on the left edge or right edge of your screen, so kind of come in from the left edge or come in from the right edge, you can actually navigate forward and backwards without using the forward and back navigation buttons inside your browser. So you can move through your browser history just by doing swipes from the left and right edges. So that's pretty cool. If you tap and hold on the add a tab icon, the little plus symbol up in the menu bar in Safari, that will allow you to see and reopen recently closed tabs. So how many times have you found, hey, you closed up a tab and you want to get right back to it? Just tap and hold on that little plus icon and you can easily get back to that tab that you just recently closed. Another thing that you can do is tap and hold on the forward and backward navigation buttons. This will give you a list of pages. So rather than, you know, tapping one at a time to get back to a page, maybe five pages back, you can simply tap and hold on the back arrow. It'll give you a drop-down list of your history. And you can go back, you know, five items in one click. So that's a handy little time saver as well. And then this was one I didn't know until recently. You can do a pinch in when you're on a web page to access all of your open tabs. To get to that visual tab view, just pinch in on a page with two or three fingers, and that will show you all of your open tabs if you use them. And if you use them, you get access to your Safari tabs. So if you're syncing your tabs through iCloud, you can see the tabs that were open on your iPhone or your iPad from your or your Mac or your iPhone, say, from your iPad. So that's a pretty cool little thing as well. And then lastly, a nice little drag and drop tip that you can use in a number of different locations, but basically the ability to kind of consolidate a bunch of items under one drag action on iOS. And where you might do this is, say you want to move multiple apps around on your home screen, right? A lot of us know that you can tap and hold on an app icon, it will start to jiggle, and then you can take that app icon and you can move it into a folder, you can move it onto another screen, you can move it into another location. Did you know you could move multiple applications at once? So if you do the tap and hold jiggle thing, start that thing happening, and then drag your first app, move it, but then just hold on to it. Don't do anything with it yet. And then with your other finger, start tapping additional icons. What you're going to see is those icons will swoop in and consolidate, sort of be magnetically drawn to that first application that you started dragging. And you can put a bunch of them in there, 5, 6, 7, as many as you want, and then you can drag them all as one grouping, maybe off to another page or into a folder, let go of them, and then they will all magically place themselves down. That is a pretty cool little thing. It's actually a great little animation too, if you've never seen it before. And not only can you do this with apps, but you can also do this with files inside the Files app. And you can also do it with emails inside the Mail application. So anytime you want to do this, you just tap and hold, you start dragging one item, and then with your other finger, start tapping other items, and they will all kind of group together under your one finger, and you can move them around as groups, take them to other locations. If you're in the Files app or the Mail app, you can actually take that little group, put it over navigation elements like back arrows or forward arrows, and actually that will allow you to move up and down the folder or file structure. So if you need to move those into other locations, you can take them all as one big group, all through drag and drop. And that's really, really handy and useful. And it's one of those things that I knew about, but I don't use all that frequently because I forget about it. So I thought this was a great opportunity to talk about some of these great little gestures that, again, you maybe didn't know before. So hopefully you learned something from this. I often learn from you. So if you have some of these gesture tips and you want to share them with me, please send those to me, maccast@gmail.com. And then last thing I want to talk to you about on the MacCast today is a couple of announcements, non-Apple announcements that happened this week. And I don't often talk about non-Apple things, but this becomes relevant because I think it shows a potential future for phone technology and maybe something that could show up in an iPhone, but I'm not entirely convinced about. And I think I'm bringing it up half because I want to talk about it and half because I want to hear your opinion on it. And that is, and you probably know where I'm going, or some of you probably know where I'm going, but foldable phones, foldable displays. Two companies this week, Samsung and Huawei, showed off their foldable OLED phone designs. They both have models coming out that have a foldable OLED display. They're both very expensive, in the $2,000 price range, $2,000 US, so not cheap technology, but very kind of cool technology in terms of its sexiness. I mean, they look great. So you have the Huawei Mate 10 and the Samsung Galaxy Fold. Samsung's design is interesting. The tablet form factor has this huge, what I'm calling side notch. Yeah, it actually has a notch in it, but it's off to one side. You don't get the notch when it's folded up. Their screen, Samsung's screen, kind of has this inner folding design. So you kind of fold it open like a book into the tablet form. And then you have a full tablet screen. And then you, when you fold it in half, you fold it closed, it has a screen on the outside. So it kind of becomes this long, narrow form factor with a screen on one side. It has kind of a metal hinge that hides the folding part, so the outer part of the screen, what would be the outer part of the screen, is covered up by this nice metal kind of hinge. And then I think it's kind of a metal, I don't know if it's actually metal surface on the back, it looked like it was. So actually kind of a cool, sexy design. I think it looks really, really nice, and much thinner than I would have expected, and even cooler than I would have expected. So the Samsung one kind of folds in on itself. The Huawei one is even more interesting because the screen wraps the other way. It kind of folds back on itself, and the screen, actually, you get a curve around the outer edge, and what you're holding is this sort of dual screen system when it's in the folded form factor, and then it folds back out kind of butterfly style, I guess, to become its tablet form factor. So really cool designs, really interesting technology, but to me, after seeing them and getting over that initial, like, wow, that's really cool factor, when the distortion field wears off a little bit, I think they leave a lot of questions in my mind as well. Specifically, that's a lot of screen, and especially with like the Huawei one, a lot of screen that's facing outward, and a lot of expensive screen that's facing outward, that it doesn't seem like there's any kind of case you could really put on that and still have it function the way it's supposed to function. You know, without disrupting the functionality, what kind of protection can you put on a device like that? I guess you could maybe put it into a sleeve, but then it makes it more difficult, like almost like a holster, but it would make it more difficult to use as a phone device. And especially with the Huawei one, when you're using it in the phone form factor, you're actually holding the screen. So I wonder about cleanliness and just it getting dirt and grime. Like if you're holding it up to your face and your palm is over the screen all the time, what's that like for durability? What's that like for cleanliness? Of course, durability is a question. Like if you're folding and unfolding this, I would imagine, I have to imagine they accounted for that, that it's going to hold up as you're bending those pixels back and forth. But again, this is new technology. It hasn't been in the hands of consumers yet. It's going to be interesting to see how that holds up. And I think most importantly, the biggest question I have is how are apps that are not specifically designed for that model phone and that form factor going to work exactly? Both Huawei and Samsung, I think, showed off some specific apps that were designed to work with their phone designs, and they looked really great. They had some great, well-thought-out features. But what happens with all of the third-party apps out there? So the Twitter clients, the Instagram clients, the various applications that we use on a day-to-day basis, note-taking applications, all of these. Each one of these form factors is very specific, even down to things like, you know, the Huawei one folds one way, the Samsung one folds another way. They're not the same aspect ratios when they're folded or unfolded. Very different things have to slide around. You know, are developers going to really design for each one of these kinds of foldable designs? Talk about how it's a big enough problem when they have to deal with just different tablet sizes or different phone screen sizes, and it's a single screen. Now you have these devices that are, for all intents and purposes, three different screens, right? Because you have the outer screen, which is one form factor. You have the unfolded screen, which is another form factor, So I guess the Huawei one has the front and back, and then the unfolded one, the Samsung one has the unfolded one, and then the screen on the outside. So you've got two screens, really, I guess, with Samsung. The point is like your apps have to adapt and be able to manage and come up on those various screens. And so how are you going to do that? What are the standards for that? And I don't think there are really any standards at this point. So as cool as this stuff is going to be, I start to question, what is the use case? What is the usability? Where does that come into play? You know, ultimately, what is the point of these things? And of course, the main point is there, right? It's you can get a big screen when you need it in a small form factor. And that is really, really noble, and I think a good idea, but is the execution fully thought out at this point? And I don't think it is. I think this is a classic case of, here's a technology, we were able to do it, we're just going to throw something into the market and see how things go. And they're doing kind of live R&D in a lot of ways on this. It's like, hey, we've got a couple things that work really well on this. Everything else is going to get kind of figured out. We just want to get this into the market so we can be first and this can be really cool. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, I'm not trying to detract from that. Again, I think this is a really cool technology. But inevitably, we're going to hear the cries in our community, in the Apple community, of, oh my gosh, Apple is once again fallen behind in smartphone technology. The iPhone is plummeting. Apple isn't innovating. They're not doing anything interesting. Oh, look at Samsung over here. They've got this foldable display. Look at Huawei over here. They've got a foldable phone. Where is Apple's foldable phone? And we're going to be hearing this just like we did with large screen sizes, just like we heard with wireless charging, just like we're going to hear with 5G technology, right? Apple is not going to be first to market there either. And I think it's important to remember why, right? Apple doesn't rush to market on this stuff because in a lot of ways, these technologies, as cool as they are not proven when they're first launched. And they're often not well thought out from the consumer perspective. They're thought out well from the technology perspective, right? Again, these designs, nice and thin, they're really cool, they've got great resolutions, they've got great feature sets, they've got great cameras in them. Nothing wrong with the technology itself. What I'm questioning is the user experience. Has that been thought out? And I guess early adopters maybe don't care about that as much, but Apple, it's a big deal to them. They want to make sure that there is an experience there and consumers are going to have a reason beyond just the cool technology for having these designs, right? They want the use case that advances the user experience Otherwise, they're not going to jump in. They're not going to do it. And will they ever jump in on foldable displays and foldable phones? Who knows? Maybe. But they have to figure out why a consumer would actually need it beyond, it just gives me a bigger screen and a smaller form factor. I don't think that's enough for Apple. And I guess another concern at this point that's being thrown around that we probably should talk about is the concern that Samsung, you know, this is a big part of their display technology. And we know Apple and Samsung haven't had the best relationship. You know, they're kind of frenemies in a lot of ways. So Samsung could withhold the foldable OLED technology from Apple. And that could, you know, in an attempt to give Samsung an edge in this space. And I do think that could happen. The thing to remember is that Samsung isn't the only display company out there, and there are other companies like LG, like Japan Display, that are working on these technologies. They're maybe not as far along as Samsung, and that's where some of the concern is. But guess what? Apple has a lot of money, and they tend to invest in a lot of companies when they want or need a technology. And we know that they've invested in LG and trying to get their foldable display technology up and running. So if Apple wanted a flexible OLED display, even if Samsung wasn't willing to provide them, I think they could figure it out. So I'm not so concerned about that. I'm more interested in, you know, is this a technology that we as a community, as we as users, really care about? Do we see use cases beyond, oh, I've got a small phone and a pretty large tablet all in one? The form factor still seems a bit off to me, like that long, slender display, maybe not really useful as a display. I don't know. I guess I'd have to really use one, right? You have to kind of have the form factor. But the operating systems and the apps have to be able to be adapted to that. And it remains to be seen if app developers are really going to flock to, you know, a Samsung or a Huawei or, if it's just one platform. Sure, if it's all Android, but if there's no standardization, you know, are they really going to jump in and tweak and adapt their application just for a Samsung phone or just for a Huawei phone? I think that's kind of a big ask for all but maybe the biggest developers out there. So maybe a Microsoft or a Adobe might do that, but a little indie developer, that's going to be a lot harder for them to invest the time and money in. So it's an interesting new development in smartphone technology. We kind of knew it was coming. Now that it's here, those are some of my thoughts on it. What do you think about it? Shoot me some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and once again thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, also Text Expander for iOS and PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. You'll find them at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And finally, if you want to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.